Let us know, brothers and sisters, contain as many shadows as we considered yesterday. Solomon, the shadow Messiah. Today we're going to look at an aspect of Solomon entitled The Ardent Bridegroom. And as an introduction to this, we're going to read from Psalm 45. And our brother, 45. The Ardent Bridegroom. Brother, watch it, please.
Thank you, Brother Chairman, and my dear brothers and sisters in the Lord Jesus Christ. This morning, then, we're going to take up the story of the marriage of Solomon, which is recorded for us in the 1st of Kings, chapter 3 and verse 1, which is where our story will begin today. The 1st of Kings, chapter 3 and the first verse. You'll remember that yesterday we said that really it is from the 1st of Kings, chapter 3, that the reign of Solomon proper begins. The first two chapters have detailed the attempts of Adonijah to usurp the throne. The second chapter has dealt with Solomon's dealing of various offenders in the kingdom. And now the story of his reign proper begins. And we're told in the very first verse of the 1st of Kings 3 that Solomon made affinity with Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and took Pharaoh's daughter and brought her unto the city of David until he had made an end of building his own house and the house of Yahweh and the wall of Jerusalem round about. So here was a marriage that had political connotations. It was designed to bind Israel and Egypt together in peaceful alliance. In fact, I think one of the interesting things about this marriage was that it tells us how mighty and powerful Israel had become. That the surrounding nations would deem it an honor to be brought into alliance with Israel. Israel had, you see, reached the zenith of its power, or was about to, under the hand of King Solomon. And so, as was commonly the case in that time, this bringing together of the royal houses of Egypt and Israel in alliance was sealed by means of this marriage between Solomon, the king of Egypt, and the daughter of Solomon, rather, the king of Israel, and between the daughter of Pharaoh, king of Egypt here. And I think that the spirit of this was that it was going to indicate the breadth and the width of Solomon's contact and reign. Many different nations and many different kingdoms and many different peoples were going to be brought into relationship with Israel during the reign of this particular king. Now, you see what the verse says. It's quite interesting, actually, because it says that he brought her into the city of David until he had made an end of building his own house and the house of Yahweh and the wall of Jerusalem round about. Now, you see, when you read that verse carefully, it seems to me that what the verse is saying is that when he married Pharaoh's daughter, that he brought her into the city of David until he could make an end of building. You see the point of emphasis here? In other words, although he married her early on in his reign, the suggestion, I think, of the verse is that it was not right at the beginning of Solomon's reign because he had already begun his building program. Now, for example, the NIV and the RSV both render the phrase until he had finished building his own house. The Jerusalem Bible says, until he could complete the building of his palace. So you see, this marriage has taken place after the building program of the temple of God and the house of the king has already begun. Now if you come to the 1st of Kings chapter 6 for a moment and to the first verse, we're told there that it came to pass in the 480th year, after the children of Israel were come out of the land of Egypt, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign over Israel, in the month Zeph, which is the second month, he began to build the house of Yahweh. So Solomon's building program, which by the way was first of all the house of God for 7 years, and then the temple palace for a further 13 years, his building program did not commence until the fourth year of his reign.
And yet back in chapter 3 and verse 1 it says that when he married Pharaoh's daughter, he brought her to the city of David until he could finish that program, which I believe he'd already begun. Now when you come back to the 1st of Kings chapter 3, and we read from verse 2 onwards, it says, only the people sacrificed in high places, because there was no house built unto the name of Yahweh until those days. And Solomon loved Yahweh, walking in the statutes of David his father. And the record goes on in the 1st of Kings chapter 3, of course, to tell us about the vision of Gibeon. How Solomon went there to offer sacrifice, how he asked for wisdom, how his speech was pleasing to God, and he was granted those blessings. And if we were to say, well, when is the 1st of Kings chapter 3 set? I believe that it is right at the very beginning of Solomon's reign. If you read the parallel record in Chronicles, I think you'll be convinced of that. In fact, Chronicles tells us that he received this vision, and then the record says, and he went back to Jerusalem and reigned over the nation. And the clear implication of the text is that this story of the vision at Gibeon that night was right at the beginning of his reign. But the 1st of Kings chapter 3 and verse 1 tells us about his marriage, which obviously actually didn't occur till at least 4 or 5 years later on. But it's brought forward in time and placed in the text here. And of course, well, we have to ask, well, why is that? And I believe that I make this suggestion anyway. I suggest that the reason why the record of his marriage is brought to this point of time is because, you see, the spirit of this chapter is of Solomon's early, earnest spirit of devotion to the truth. You see verse 3? Solomon loved Yahweh, walking in the statutes of David his father. Verse 9, give therefore thy servant an understanding heart to judge thy people. Verse 10, and the speech pleased Yahweh that Solomon had asked this thing. So you see, here was Solomon at the beginning of his reign, when there was no doubts about the spirit of dedication that he had to the truth. Now, it's inconceivable that Solomon at that stage of his life would marry anybody who did not embrace the truth. And I think that's the point of why the story of his marriage is brought into this chapter, even though, in fact, it didn't occur till 4 years or 5 years later on. As you see, when you look at the spirit of Solomon at this time of his reign, one just cannot imagine him marrying anybody, political alliance or otherwise, who did not embrace the truth. And I believe this woman did. I believe that fits the story and the context of this marriage. This girl was not going to be any ordinary girl. She might be the daughter of Pharaoh, but as far as being queen of Israel was concerned, she was going to become another Rahab, another Ruth. Thy people shall be my people, and thy God, my God, was going to be the spirit of this girl. In fact, if we come to the end of the story, in the 1st of Kings chapter 11, we read some rather interesting words in the very first verse of that chapter. In the 1st of Kings chapter 11, we're told there, it says, But King Solomon loved many strange women, together with the daughter of Pharaoh, a woman of the Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Zidonians, and Hittites. So you see, the story tells us here, in the 1st of Kings 11, verse 1, that later on, Solomon was going to take a number of other wives and concubines, and no doubt for similar purposes of strategic alliances. But you see, I think that even then, this particular woman, the daughter of Pharaoh, is deliberately set aside from all those other women that he eventually met. You see the wording of this verse, and I'm taking the marginal reference here. But King Solomon loved many strange women besides the daughter of Pharaoh. Oh, she wasn't a strange woman. No, she, as far as the divine record is concerned, she was his wife. But these other ladies, these other women, they were going to be strange wives as far as Solomon was concerned. Now you see what happens. We're told in verse 5 that Solomon went after Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Zidonians, and after Milcom, the abomination of the Moabites. Verse 7, then Solomon did build an high place for Chemosh, the abomination of Moab in the hill that's before Jerusalem, and for Molech the abomination of the children of Ammon, and likewise did he for all his strange wives. You see the point of the text here. He did it for all his strange wives. But the one God that isn't worshipped in the first of Kings 11 is any god out of Egypt. He worshipped the god of the Zidonians, verse 5, the god of the Ammonites, verse 5, the god of the Moabites, verse 7. There is no reference to any worship of an Egyptian god in this chapter, and I don't believe he did. Because she wasn't a strange wife. She was his true wife. She was different, this girl. She had embraced the hope of Israel. And by the way, that's in contrast, if we come over the page, we're told in chapter 11, verse 40, look at by way of contrast with the next king who sits upon the throne. And we're told in the first of Kings 11, verse 40, that Solomon sought therefore to kill Jeroboam, and Jeroboam arose and fled into Egypt, unto Shishak, king of Egypt, and was in Egypt until the death of Solomon. We turn over the page to chapter 12 and verse 28, and we're told that when Jeroboam became king, the king took counsel and made two calves of gold and said, it's too much for you to go up to Jerusalem, behold, these be thy gods, O Israel. And Jeroboam went down to Egypt, spent a short time there, came back, and very soon after, the worship of Egypt was introduced into Israel. Not so in the days of Solomon, because his wife did not become a strange wife. She did not ask him to burn incense to strange gods. She, we believe, it turned out to be one who embraced the hope of the truth. She was truly going to be the wife of his covenant and the wife of his youth. And Solomon should have heeded the advice of his father, which was given to him in the book of Proverbs. We won't turn it up, but in Proverbs chapter 5, you might just like to take a note of the reference. In Proverbs chapter 5, Solomon was counseled by his own father, let thy fountain be blessed, and rejoice with the wife of thy youth. Let her be as the loving hind and pleasant roe. Let her breasts satisfy thee at all times, and be thou ravished always with her love. And why wilt thou, my son, be ravished with a strange woman and embrace the bosom of a stranger? And that's exactly what Solomon did to his own ultimate downfall. If only he'd heeded his father's advice and be satisfied always with the wife of his youth. And this was this girl. She was going to be the wife of his youth. And so these strange women were going to come and cloud the story later on. But at the time he married Pharaoh's daughter, of course, none of that had happened. Solomon was young, he was pure, he had lofty ideals, he had strong commitment to the truth, and their marriage is set against the backdrop of the early part of his reign. Must have been a wonderful wedding. One of the we know that even today, that a royal wedding is something that occasions a great deal of interest, isn't it? People enjoy a royal wedding. There's something very grand about it. And this, no doubt, was a state occasion to remember. And fortunately, there was someone that was there who wrote down some details of the wedding. They wrote down part of the speeches that were given. They gave a description of the bride and the groom. They talked about who was there at the wedding and who gave presents. Now, where is all that recorded? Well, of course, the answer is Psalm 45, which we had taken as our reading together this morning. So let's have a look at Psalm 45, which we believe was a special marriage ode or marriage hymn composed to commemorate the marriage of this couple together. So the 45th Psalm, then, was written, we believe, concerning this matter. Now, we haven't got time to expound Psalm 45 today, but briefly we might just say that the essential breakup of the psalm is that from verses 1 to 8, or perhaps to verse 9, is the first part of the psalm is devoted to a description of the king, the glory and the majesty of the bridegroom himself. And then from verses 9 or 10 through to verse 16 is a description of the queen, what she wore, who was there, the presents that were going to be given, the joy of the marriage that was going to occur. And then the last verse, verse 17, talks about the bridal couple and, of course, the hope that that in the future their children would live on after them and carry on the name of this happy couple, who we believe to be, of course, Solomon and Pharaoh's daughter. Now, without expounding the psalm in detail, what I would like to do this morning is just to briefly take up one or two points of contact between the psalm and the life of Solomon, just so we've satisfied ourselves that this psalm really does belong to Solomon's reign. Now, that's actually quite important, and you'll see the value of that a little later on in today's story. It's important that we establish the links between Psalm 45 and the time of Solomon. So here's a few of them. Now, for example, you'll see in verse 2 that the psalmist says, "Thou art fairer than the children of men, grace is poured into thy lips." So here's a description of Solomon, the king. "Thou art fairer than the children of men." Do you know, it's interesting that David himself is described in the 1st of Samuel, chapter 16, in verse 12, as a very handsome man. This is his father, David. So were a number of David's sons. We're told in the 2nd of Samuel, chapter 14, in verse 25, that Absalom was flawless. We're told in the 1st of Kings, chapter 1, verse 6, that Adonijah was very striking. Now, these are all sons from David, who was himself a handsome man. But imagine this boy, whose mother just happened to be Bathsheba, who was described as very beautiful. 2nd of Samuel 11, verse 2. So he's got a handsome father and a strikingly beautiful mother, and the psalmist says, and no doubt with more than just poetical license, "Thou art fairer than the children of men." No doubt Solomon was a very striking-looking person. He says, the psalmist goes on to say in the sixth verse, "Thy throne, O God, is forever and ever. The scepter of thy kingdom is a right scepter." Now, if you just hold your hand in Psalm 45 for a moment, in the first of Chronicles, chapter 28, and verse 5, let's just see if we can capture the spirit of that phrase out of the psalm. In the 1st of Chronicles 28 and verse 5, it says, "And of all my sons, for Yahweh has given me many sons, he has chosen Solomon my son to sit upon the throne of the kingdom of Yahweh over Israel." So you see, David understood that the choice of Solomon to sit upon the throne was a matter of divine choice. But it wasn't just that. If you come to the 1st of Kings chapter 2 and verse 45, we're told that not only was he going to sit upon the throne, but there it says that as a result of his treatment of various individuals, the end of the verse, "and the kingdom was established in the hand of Solomon." So the desire of David was that his son might rule peacefully upon the throne, that it was divinely ordained that Solomon should sit upon that throne. And we're told in the 1st of Kings 2, verse 45, that that's indeed what happened. The kingdom was established in the hand of Solomon. Now you see, if you were a poet writing a psalm about the marriage of the king, what good wish would you want to bring upon the king? You're talking about his marriage. He's a young man, he's sitting upon the throne, as a result of divine choice. Now, if you were the psalmist, what would you want to write in a marriage psalm about the king? Well, of course, this is how the NIV puts Psalm 45, verse 6. Changes the spirit of it just a little. "Your throne, O God, will last forever and ever." Now, that's just what we'd expect in a marriage ode that celebrates the stability and permanence of the king's reign. Isn't that what you'd wish upon the king? He's just about to be married. "Your throne, O mighty one, will last forever and ever. Long live the king," is still the spirit that is cried about kings, isn't it? And especially so at their marriage would we wish that upon the ruler. What about Psalm 45, verse 7? "Thou lovest righteousness and hatest wickedness. Therefore God, thy God, hath anointed thee with the oil of gladness above thy fellows." Now, there's an interesting connection there, isn't there, with what we looked at in our opening study. Remember how you see Adonijah claimed the throne, invited all the other sons of David, but that ceremony was broken up, and that in the second coronation of Solomon, that all the other sons had to come and submit to Solomon, didn't they? Thou hast been anointed with the oil of gladness above thy fellows. And so he was, because of all the sons of David, his fellows, his brethren, this man had been lifted up and given the anointing of kingship above them all. And that special selection of Solomon above his brethren is celebrated in the words of this particular psalm. In Psalm 45 and verse 9 it says that upon thy right hand did sit the queen in gold of Ophir. Gold of Ophir. Now we're told in the first of Kings chapter 9 in verses 26 to 28 that Solomon built a fleet of ships with Tyre. Well, we might just go and have a look at that one. The first of Kings chapter 9. These are just thought links, aren't they, to the life and times of Solomon. In the first of Kings chapter 9 and verse 26, we're told that King Solomon made a navy of ships in Ezion-Geber, which is beside Eloth, on the shore of the Red Sea in the land of Edom, and Hiram sent in the navy his servants, shipmen that had knowledge of the sea, with the servants of Solomon, and they came to Ophir and fetched from thence gold, 420 talents, and brought it to the king. And so one of the booties, one of the spoils that the ships of Tarsus regularly brought back to the coasts of Palestine in the days of Solomon, as a result of his cooperation with Hiram, king of Tyre, was magnificent treasure of the gold of Ophir. And when the queen comes out, arrayed in all her garments on this state occasion of the wedding, she's clad in the gold of Ophir, says Psalm 45 and verse 9. And of course, well, what about Psalm 45 verse 10? Well, this really is a striking connection, isn't it? Hearken, O daughter, and consider, and incline thine ear. Forget also thine own people and thy father's house, so shall the king greatly desire thy beauty, for he is thy Lord, and worship thou him. Now you see, here we have a special exhortation to the bride. But you notice the fact that the bride was the daughter of Pharaoh, Lord of Egypt, makes that exhortation ring with special significance, doesn't it? You see, it says here, forget thy father's house. And wouldn't you say that if it turned out that your father was the king of Egypt? That she of all women had to learn that lesson. She wasn't just an Israelitish girl. She had a lot to turn her back on, this girl, in order to come to the truth. She had to truly forget her father's house. It's an appeal to her to convert fully to the hope of Israel. You see those key words? Hearken, consider, incline, forget. And you see what verse 11 says? So shall the king greatly desire thy beauty. And so you see what verse 11 tells us is that the basis of the king's attraction to her would be her willing separation to him. And his faith. There was going to be the key of this marriage. You want this marriage to be successful? Well, the psalmist says, as a special plea to this daughter out of Egypt, you must forsake the past and be separated to your bridegroom and to the things that he believes in, so shall he greatly desire thy beauty. And that was going to be the basis of the success of this marriage, that she was prepared to convert fully to the hope of Israel, into which house she had come. And Jewish tradition states that this girl indeed did become a Jewish proselyte. So the nation was there at the wedding, but there were visitors as well. We're told in verse 12, the daughter of Tyre shall be there with a gift. Even the rich among the people shall entreat thy favour. Now you see, we said before that this marriage occurred after Solomon's building projects had commenced. But if you come back to the first of Kings chapter 5, we're told that before he commenced his building projects, that he decided he needed to organize some materials and some labor. And so in the first of Kings chapter 5, and verse 1 it says, "And Hiram king of Tyre sent his servants unto Solomon." And as a result of certain agreements they made, we're told in the 12th verse, "And Yahweh gave Solomon wisdom as he promised him, and there was peace between Hiram and Solomon, and they two made a league together." So you see, Solomon has entered into a covenant, a trade agreement with the king of Tyre in order that he might begin his building project, and that's well before his marriage. So therefore we wouldn't be at all surprised, would we, if at the wedding we saw an ambassador from the kingdom of Tyre there. And that's what the psalm says, isn't it? "The daughter of Tyre shall be there with a gift." And finally, in Psalm 45 and verse 13, it says, "The king's daughter is all glorious within." The RSV says, "The princess." So you see, the bride of this psalm is already of royal descent herself. The princess. The phrase is really reminiscent of the title that is consistently given to her throughout the book of Kings, Pharaoh's daughter. The king's daughter, says the psalm. And that's exactly how she's described throughout the text of the book of Kings. Pharaoh's daughter. So you see, what we're saying is that we believe that Psalm 45 was in fact the story of their marriage. It celebrates this wonderful occasion when Solomon took as his bride Pharaoh's daughter, but that she really did come into the truth. That he married her at a time of his own dedication and commitment to the truth, when his ideals were pure and untouched in the early part of his reign, and that these two in fact made a very happy couple indeed. And the mother of the bride was there. We know that because in the Song of Solomon, we're told, if you'd like to come and have a look at that one, the mother of the bride was there, because in the Song of Solomon chapter 3 and verse 11, there appears to be an allusion there to that. Did I say the mother of the bride? I should have said the mother of the groom. The mother of the groom was there because we're told in the Song of Solomon 3 and verse 11, "Go forth, O ye daughters of Zion, and behold King Solomon with the crown wherewith his mother crowned him in the day of his espousals and in the day of the gladness of his heart." So the mother of the groom was there in order to place a special crown upon the head of Solomon on that day. But you see, it wasn't just the mother of the groom that was there. The father of the bride said, "Well, I'm going to give a present as well." And he did. Does anyone know what the present of the father of the bride was? Well, we're told that in the 1st of Kings chapter 9. If you come to the 1st of Kings chapter 9, the father of the bride wasn't going to be outdone by the mother of the groom. He says, "If you can give a present, so can I." And he says, "I'm going to give a much better one than you." So in the 1st of Kings chapter 9, we're told in the 16th verse these words. It says, "For Pharaoh king of Egypt had gone up and taken Giza and burnt it with fire, and slain the Canaanites that dwelt in the city, and given it for a present unto his daughter, Solomon's wife." Now Giza originally belonged to Ephraim, but they had failed to drive out the Canaanites from the city. We're told that in Joshua 16 verse 10 and Judges 1 verse 29. So Giza belonged to Ephraim, but they never ever did manage to drive the Canaanites out. And what Ephraim lacked the faith to accomplish, a Gentile monarch performed as an act of support for Solomon. The NIV translates that phrase, "given it for a present." The NIV says, "then gave it as a wedding gift to his daughter." Rotherhams in the Revised Standard Version says, "he gave it as a dowry to his daughter." So whilst the mother of the groom says, "I've got a little crown for you, son," the father of the bride says, "I've got a little city for you, daughter." And he swept out the Canaanites and gave Giza to his daughter, which, by the way, was very significant because Solomon says, verse 17, did build Giza, and it became in fact one of the key fortress cities of the nation. In fact, at Giza, a slab of stone has been discovered with a Hebrew inscription on it that dates back to the 10th century, the time of Solomon. And what it proves to us archaeologically is that the city of Giza did pass from Philistine hands back into Jewish hands during this period of time. So the marriage took place. It was a wonderful day indeed for the nation. The record tells us, in fact, that his wife dwelt in the city of David. Remember, the first of Kings chapter 3, verse 1 said he brought her to the city of David until he could complete his building projects. She must have been a fairly patient wife, really, because he started his building projects in his fourth year and then proceeded to build for the next 20 years. So it was a wee while before she moved into her new house, and yet he did do that, because we're told in the first of Kings chapter 7, if you come to the first of Kings chapter 7 and verse 8, we're told that what Solomon did in fact was he expanded the construction of his own house and added a special wing for his wife. In the first of Kings chapter 7 and verse 8 it says, and his house where he dwelt had another court within the porch, which was of the light work. Solomon made also an house for Pharaoh's daughter, whom he had taken to wife, like unto this court. Now you see to me that this verse tells us, it really emphasizes the unique status of this woman as his principal wife. The divine narrative never ever says that he did that for anybody else. There is just no other wife of Pharaoh of whom it is recorded that anything special was done, but tremendous care and attention was lavished on this particular woman. I have read a narrative that suggests that he did all this because he was worried about how the king of Egypt would feel. I don't think that's the way the Bible's written. The Bible's written to present us with divine thoughts. And I think that the teaching of these passages is that Solomon loved this girl. She was special. And he built a house for this wife. He treated her like no other person. And so, although it must have taken a considerable amount of time to construct the palace, when it was finished, she dwelt in state right alongside his own palace. In fact, we're told of the day when he shifted her in, because in the second of Chronicles chapter 8, we're given the story of the moment when his building was finished and he brought her to her new palace. The second of Chronicles chapter 8 says in the 11th verse, and Solomon brought up the daughter of Pharaoh out of the city of David unto the house that he had built for her. For he said, my wife shall not dwell in the house of David, king of Israel, because the places are holy whereunto the ark of Yahweh hath come. 2 Chronicles 8, verse 11. Notice, by the way, that verse 11 says, Solomon brought up the daughter of Pharaoh out of the city of David. So where was her new palace? If they came up out of the city of David, where did they go? Anyone like to have a stab on that? Where was the temple, the royal palace, rather? Sorry? Yes, that's a pretty good guess. It wasn't in Milo. It wasn't actually in Milo, because Milo was the retaining wall, but the area that Milo retained was actually called, well, does anyone know what it was called? I'll tell you where it is. It's the region between the temple area and the city of David, which was a bit lower down. Now, what's the bit in between called? Anyone know? It was known as Ophel, quite right. And Milo was the retaining wall that kept the area of Milo in. Now, what happened was Solomon built his whole royal compound upon the area of Ophel, which was a little bit up from the city of David, but not quite as high as the temple compound itself. And so this record is quite right when it says that he brought her up out of the city of David. Yes, indeed he did, because they ascended up into Ophel, and that's why he was so worried about building Milo, because he'd expanded that whole area and needed to strengthen the retaining walls. Now, you see what it says in this verse. It says that he brought her unto the house that he'd built for her, for he said, my wife shall not dwell in the house of David, king of Israel, because the places are holy whereunto the ark of Yahweh hath come. And it's been suggested that there was, this was a criticism in some way of this wife. I don't think that that's the case. I don't think there's any criticism of her implied in this verse at all. And I'll tell you why I don't think there's any criticism implied of her, because it says that my wife shall not dwell in the house of David. I don't think there's anything wrong with that, because Solomon didn't dwell there either. He didn't dwell in the house of David either. He had built a palace for himself that also lay beyond the city of David. There was nothing personal directed against her. In fact, Rotherham translates this phrase, "No wife of mine shall dwell in the house of David." It wasn't anything against her personally, but you see, what he's saying is that the city of David was the place where the Ark of God had resided, because when David brought the Ark to Zion, of course, the temple hasn't yet been built, and that area hadn't been, in fact, selected, so he brought the Ark into the city of David. All Solomon was saying here is that there is some special sanctity related to the holy places of the city of David, because the Ark has dwelt there for some time, and it's not a good place for her to be dwelling. "Neither do I dwell there," he says, "so in fact we've built a new palace for the two of us a little further to the north." In fact, you want to see something very interesting? Far from being a criticism of this girl, the very story of the ascent of the Ark is paralleled by the story of the ascent of his wife. Now just have a look at this. So we have two ascents from the city of David. Now, by the way, we can see that area now. We're looking, which side are we looking at? Well, we're actually looking across towards the east. So these hills here, well, of course, that's really the Mount of Olives, isn't it, on the far side. Here is the city of David on the lower slopes of Mount Zion. Here is the region of Ophel, and here higher again is the temple area on Mount Moriah, a little higher. So Ophel is this middle region between the old city of David and the new area of the Temple Mount. The royal palace was built in here and strengthened with a huge retaining wall known as Milo. So that the ark came from the city of David up to the temple area, and the bride of Solomon came from the city of David up to the palace area. So you see how there is a paralleling of ideas there. We're told in the second of Chronicles that Solomon assembled the elders to bring up the Ark of the Covenant of Yahweh out of the city of David up to the oracle of the house, which of course he had built. He'd built the temple. And Psalm 132 verse 8 captures the spirit of that moment when he said, "Arise, O Yahweh, into thy rest, thou and the ark of thy strength." And there's a very similar spirit here, isn't there, to the removal now of Pharaoh's daughter. Solomon brought up the daughter of Pharaoh, being the wife of his covenant, out of the city of David, under the house that he'd built for her, and no doubt with some such tender phrase as the Song of Solomon, "Rise up, my love, my fair one, and come away." So, you see, the very story of the removing of the ark, in fact, is given a strange parallel in the narrative here, with the occasion when he removed Pharaoh's daughter up into the place which he'd built for her. If you come to the 1st of Kings chapter 9, we actually have the parallel record in Kings of this same moment of time. And you'll see from there that there is certainly nothing critical recorded concerning his wife on this occasion. In the 1st of Kings chapter 9 and verse 24, this is the slightly simpler narrative given in the book of Kings. It simply says, "But Pharaoh's daughter came up out of the city of David unto her house which Solomon had built for her, and then did he begin Milo." So again we have the ascent northwards noted in the text. In fact, it seems to me, if you just read that verse carefully, that the simple statement of that verse seems to capture the spirit of care and of thoughtfulness that Solomon showed towards this girl. She came up out of the city of David unto the house which he had built for her. There was a genuine attachment here. So what did Solomon learn then from this experience of marriage? Remember how we said that one of the funny things about the book of Kings is we never get into the feelings of the king. Oh, he did all these things, but how did he feel? What did he really think about her? Well, I believe that it was the experience of this marriage that prompted the writing of the Song of Solomon. Now, I want you to listen to me very carefully in terms of what I say about this, because I'm not saying what some people might think I'm saying. I think that it was the experience of this marriage that prompted the writing of the Song of Solomon, but the Song of Solomon is not the story of their marriage. There's been a lot of silly things said about the Song of Solomon. Maybe you've come across some of them yourself. Stories about how that really the key character is a shepherd girl who Solomon sees and rushes her off to the royal palace, and the shepherd comes to try and get her back, and there's all this sort of argument going on with Solomon trying to convince her to stay and the shepherd trying to get her to go home with him. And I don't think that fits the divine narrative at all in the context of the spiritual feelings of the Song of Solomon. And I believe that the story of this marriage was the backdrop to the Song of Solomon, but the song itself has got nothing to do specifically with their marriage. But it was the marriage provided the moment of time, as it were, in Solomon's life for his thoughts to move on to what finally was penned as the Song of Solomon. Now, the key here is just to draw a parallel. And now we see why it's important to establish that Psalm 45 did in fact have relationship to Solomon's reign, because we notice here that there is a set of definite parallel ideas between the Song of Solomon and Psalm 45. They both have the same theme. It's the story of the love between the king and his bride. They're both songs. Now, Psalm 45 is described in its superscription as a song of love. Song of Solomon, chapter 1, verse 1 says, the song of songs, which is Solomon. They both have the same characters. They both have the king and the bride and the virgins. They both use perfume and incense as symbols. They're both allegorical of Christ and his bride. Psalm 45 is taken up concerning Christ in Hebrews chapter 1, and Song of Solomon chapter 4 is taken up concerning the bride in Ephesians chapter 5. And we believe, therefore, that both these writings are based upon the same historical incident, and that is the marriage of Solomon to the daughter of Pharaoh. That was the background, as it were, to the writing of the Song of Solomon. Now, just a couple of other thoughts then to just establish that a bit further. I just want you to notice the connections of thought that exist between the two narratives. So, first of all, let's have a look at the bridegroom. So on the one side, we have the story of the bridegroom in Psalm 45, and here on the other side, we have some references to the bridegroom in the Song of Solomon. So Psalm 45 speaks about things touching the king. The Song of Solomon makes similar reference to the king, describes him as, thou art fairer than the children of men. And the same term is taken up in the Song of Solomon, behold, thou art fair, my beloved, says the bride concerning the bridegroom. Grace is poured into thy lips, says the psalm. His lips were like lilies, says the Song of Solomon. Gird thy sword upon thy thigh, O most mighty, says the psalm. The valiant of Israel, the mighty ones of Israel, have their sword girded upon their thigh, says the Song of Solomon. In the psalm, the bridegroom is anointed with the oil of gladness above thy fellows. In the Song of Solomon, there is reference made to the day of the gladness of his heart. In the psalm, it is said that his garments smell of myrrh. In the Song of Solomon, the bridegroom gathers together his myrrh, says the fifth chapter. So you see, the very thoughts that are taken up concerning the bridegroom in the Song of Solomon are remarkably similar to the thoughts that are expressed concerning the bridegroom in the 45th Psalm. And if that's true, of course, of the bridegroom, then we find that the same thing is similarly true of the bride as well. So Psalm 45 speaks about the fact that there were king's daughters and honourable women that surrounded the bride on the occasion of the wedding. And the Song of Solomon says there are 70 queens and 80 concubines that all surround the royal queen. The psalm says that the king shall greatly desire thy beauty, and the Song of Solomon says, O thou fairest among women, and the word fairest in the Song of Solomon is drawn from the same Hebrew word for beauty in the psalm. She's described in the psalm as all glorious within, the king's daughter. And the same expression is used of her in the Song of Solomon, how beautiful she is, O prince's daughter, says the Song of Solomon, the same royal descent, you see. The virgins, her companions that follow her, says the psalm. And the same expression in the Song of Solomon, therefore the virgins love thee and will run after her. The psalm says she shall be brought into the king's palace. The Song of Solomon says the king hath brought me into his chambers. The psalm says with gladness and rejoicing, the song says we will be glad and rejoice. You see, I believe there's absolutely no doubt when you look at this carefully that the Song of Solomon has its roots in Psalm 45. So that if Psalm 45 is the psalm that commemorates the marriage of Solomon to Pharaoh's daughter, then what we're saying is that the similarities here tell us that this at least was the background for the writing of the Song of Solomon. And I believe that that is the most satisfactory explanation of how the Song of Solomon came about. There's certain marked connections here. But can I just say again, I believe that that was the background to the writing of the Song of Solomon, but the Song of Solomon is not actually about their marriage. What happened was, his marriage stimulated Solomon's thinking into a highly spiritual reverie upon Messiah himself. And the Song of Solomon was the result. You can't go into the Song of Solomon and try and work out all the details to match it up to Solomon's life. It just doesn't work. It isn't there. I believe it's not meant to be there. It is not a match. It is an allegory, a reflection on marriage. It might have been that his own marriage stimulated him into writing it, but writing what he did was in fact in no way connected with his own marriage. In fact, the Chaldee Targum heads the Song of Solomon with this phrase. It describes it as the songs and hymns which Solomon the prophet, the king of Israel, uttered in the spirit of prophecy before the Lord. That's how the Targum heads the Song of Solomon. And I believe it's right. The Song of Solomon was, in fact, a prophecy, a reverie, a spiritual meditation. Now, our interest in the Song of Solomon is not so much to expound it, because obviously we haven't got time, but because of the insight it gives us into the mind and thinking of the king. And what a mind he must have had. You see, we're in the presence of a very deep person here. Solomon was a very deep person. Must have, in fact, been terribly lonely for Solomon, you know. He often had such wonderfully deep thoughts, and there was very few people that could enter into thinking with him. The king stood alone in many things. Now, just think about the mind of Solomon as he goes to write the Song of Solomon. Because in this story, he understands and writes the parts for all the actors in the drama. He doesn't just write about the bridegroom. He writes about the bride. And he writes about the virgins. He understands the feelings of all the players in the story of this marriage, in the Song of Solomon. When we come to the groom in the Song of Solomon, we have Solomon writing about his thoughtful care for the bride, about his loving support of her, and the gentle way in which he quietly woos her. And then he writes about the bride, and we have the story of her desperate uncertainty and of her timid shyness, and of the gradual unfolding of her confidence in him, and the final developing of the warmth of her love. And Solomon takes the part of the bride, and he understands that. And he also writes about the virgins, and he senses their excitement as the wedding approaches. And he sees their maidenly sighs of satisfaction as the bride and groom come together and as the marriage proceeds. He feels exactly how the virgins feel. Now, what sort of a man can write that sort of story, brothers and sisters? Who can take the part of the bridegroom and the bride and the virgins and knows all of those feelings? That's the man that we're dealing with. This is the king. Here we have the beating of the heart and the blushing of the cheek and the trembling of the body. and the engulfing warmth of the final mutual love of this bride and this groom in the story. And yet somehow it's all written with such freshness and such purity and such delicacy and such nobility that there's nothing earthy or sensual about this story. It is the greatest discourse on love between Christ and his bride found anywhere in Scripture. You had to have a wonderful mind to write that story. No wonder Rabbi Akiba said, "All the writings are holy, but the Song of Songs is the holy of holies." Now, where did he get that knowledge from? I believe that he drew on his own marriage experience to write that song. It was from his early days, when his heart was still right before his God, when he was still pure in his zeal for the truth, when he took Pharaoh's daughter to wife, when he taught her the truth and loved her as the wife of his youth. I believe that was the moment for the writing of the book, the Song of Solomon. He's an amazing person, brothers and sisters, a very, very deep person, this man, King Solomon. And of course, the whole story that we've looked at this morning is, of course, an allegory in itself, isn't it? The whole thing points forward to greater things to come. Now, just by way of conclusion, let's just have a look at two or three matters here where the spirit of this story is taken up elsewhere in the divine record. Echoes of Solomon. Now you see, here we have in Psalm 45 the exhortation to the bride. "Forget also thine own people," said the psalm. Isn't that the spirit of Philippians? Forgetting those things which are behind and reaching forth unto those things which are before. "I press toward the mark of the prize of the high calling of God in Christ Jesus. For our conversation is in heaven, from whence we look for the Saviour." You know, I believe that that little snatch in Philippians is taken from the psalm. In fact, you'll find it cross-referenced in your margin in the book of Philippians. It's cross-referenced back to Psalm 45. But this is no longer Solomon and his bride, brothers and sisters. This is us. It's an echo out of Solomon's life, but into the life of the Lord now. So if we really love Christ, are we prepared to forget those things which are behind and to press forward to those things that are before? You know, our lives are filled with so much tension and worry and stress and burden, especially in this present life. I know there's a lot of people at the school that feel that right now. Well, the truth's all about forgetting what's behind and reaching forth to that which lies before. And that which lies before, my dear brothers and sisters, is the bridegroom. Now, do we love him? Are we reaching forward? Is that our spirit? And remember the story of the psalm, that the king will be most attracted to the bride if she willingly separates herself to him. That's exactly how Christ feels about us. That's the story of the truth, isn't it? Are we willingly being separated from everything about us in order that we might draw closer to him? That spirit in Philippians is surely taken directly from the story of Psalm 45 and the marriage of Solomon. What about this one here? The gladness and the joy of that moment of time. Psalm 45 said, "She shall be brought unto the king in raiment of needlework, with gladness and rejoicing they shall enter into the king's palace." Now that's Revelation 19, isn't it? Has to be. Let us be glad and rejoice, for the marriage of the Lamb is come. And to her it was given that she should be arrayed in fine linen, that she might go into the presence of the king. And the spirit of that day is captured right out of Solomon's marriage and taken forward into the story of that which is yet to come in the marriage of the Lamb, Revelation 19. Let us be glad and rejoice. That's straight out of Psalm 45. Well, is that how we feel? Are we looking forward to that day of gladness and rejoicing? And if so, then what are we doing about our fine linen garments, clean and white? The purity of our ideals, the integrity of our principles, day by day for the truth, living righteously, being prepared for Him. Is that how we feel? It ought to be. Because that day of gladness and rejoicing is yet set before us. And the same excitement that was there in the day of the marriage of Solomon to the daughter of Pharaoh will be there, but 1,000 times multiplied when the multitudinous bride is brought before the greater than Solomon.